On a clear morning in Miletus, the air feels almost weightless. A faint breeze moves between the houses, stirring dust in the streets, filling sails in the harbor, rising as a shimmer over the tiled roofs as the day warms. Most people barely notice it unless it fails. Only when the wind drops and the city lies still in heavy heat do they realize how much their comfort depends on something they cannot see. For Anaximenes, the third of the old Milesian inquirers, that invisible element was not an afterthought, but the key to everything. Where Thales had said that all is water, and Anaximander had spoken of the indefinable Apeiron, Anaximenes answered in a single ordinary Greek word, air. He did not mean air in the trivial background sense of whatever happens to be between things. He meant air as the continuous, unseen substance that pervades everything, sustains life, and by becoming thicker or thinner, gives birth to all the other forms we encounter, wind and cloud, water and earth, stone and flame. In his universe, the first principle is not a distant, abstract force, but the very breath you draw in as you listen. To understand the world, he suggests, you might begin by understanding what happens when you inhale and exhale. Anaximenes lived in the 6th century BCE, probably a younger contemporary of Anaximander, perhaps his associate or student. Like his predecessors, he came from Miletus, a city that had become an unlikely laboratory for early philosophical experiment. On the surface, Miletus is just another Ionian port, noisy, practical, and vulnerable, wedged between land empires and the sea. Beneath that surface, though, the place hums with a particular kind of curiosity. Merchants bring tales of Egyptian geometry and Babylonian astronomy. Sailors report strange winds and currents from far coasts. Artisans refine techniques for dyeing cloth, firing pottery, casting metal. The idea that nature might be understood in terms of regular processes and materials is in the air, an atmosphere of speculation as real, if less tangible, than the breeze from the harbor. Thales had taken the first step by naming water the arche, the underlying stuff of everything. Anaximander had complicated the picture, arguing that no familiar element could serve as the origin because each has a definite quality. Water is wet, fire hot, air light, earth heavy. The origin must be qualitative neutral, he argued, a boundless and indeterminate Apeiron from which opposites separate. Anaximenes enters this conversation and, in a sense, splits the difference between his two predecessors. He returns to a concrete, observable element as first principle, air, but insists that it can, by processes of thinning and thickening, become all other things. In doing so, he introduces one of the most fertile ideas in the history of thought, that qualitative differences may be explained by quantitative differences in a single underlying stuff. If you want a glimpse into his way of reasoning, you can perform the experiment later writers attribute to him. Hold your hand in front of your mouth and exhale with your lips relaxed and open. The breath feels warm. Now purse your lips and blow. The air on your skin feels cool. In both cases, it is your own breath, the same lungful of air, yet the way it is released makes it warmer or colder. For Anaximenes, this simple observation reveals something fundamental. When air is more rarefied, it becomes warmer. When it is compressed, it cools and condenses. Extend this pattern and you can sketch a whole sequence. Extremely rarefied air is fire. Less rarefied, it is the invisible atmosphere around us. Condensed somewhat, it becomes wind, then cloud, then water. Further condensation yields earth, and the densest air becomes stone. All the elements on this view are just stages in the continuous process of air's thickening and thinning. The elegance of this vision is easy to miss, because it sounds at first like a simplistic catalog. But set it against the intellectual landscape of his time, and it appears as a real breakthrough. To say that earth and stone are extremely dense air is to insist that the differences between the most solid and the most intangible things in the world are not differences of kind, but of degree. There is no impassable ontological chasm between fire and rock. They are points on the same spectrum. This way of thinking opens the door for later theories in which heat, color, or even consciousness arise from variations in something more basic, in a loose way. Anaximenes is already groping toward the idea that you can explain complex qualities by appealing to simpler, continuous processes. Air, for him, is not only the material of the cosmos, but the image of soul. He is reported to have said that just as our soul, being air, holds us together and governs us, so breath and air encompass the whole world. In this sentence, a powerful analogy is compressed. To live is to breathe, when breath leaves the body. The organism collapses into a corpse. The animating principle seems bound up with that subtle, invisible flow. If what keeps a human being unified is an airy soul circulating inside, perhaps what keeps the cosmos itself in order is a vast counterpart of that same principle, an enveloping life breath. Without invoking mythic deities in human form, Anaximenes finds a way to connect the microcosm and the macrocosm. The air in your lungs and the air stretching from horizon to horizon are manifestations of the same reality. His picture of the world's structure fits neatly with this view. Like Anaximander, he thinks of the earth as suspended in the middle of things, not resting on anything. But instead of a cylindrical earth poised in equilibrium, some reports say Anaximenes imagined it as a flat, broad disk, like a leaf, floating on compressed air. Just as our bodies are supported by the air we breathe and move through, the earth is supported by the air beneath it, which acts like a cushion. Above and around this central disk stretch further layers of air, thinner as they rise, and within these strata, the heavenly bodies move. The sun, moon, and stars are not independent divine beings, but fiery material carried around by the rotation of the heavens, like coals fixed to a transparent wheel of air. The stars, in some accounts, are nailed to crystalline surfaces. In others, they drift in the encircling breath. Again, the details may sound quaint, but the impulse is striking. Anaximenes is trying to explain the heavens in terms of the same substance that explains earthly life. The difference between the fire of the sun and the fire on a hearth is not a difference of origin, but of configuration and distance. The same processes that produce cloud and rain shape the forms of things beyond the atmosphere. Nature is a continuum. There are no special realms exempt from the basic principles. This instinct, to refuse to cordon off the sky as wholly alien and instead treat it as part of one coherent system, is one that later science will share. Compared with Anaximander's abstract apeiron, Anaximenes' air has the virtue of being directly experienced. You can feel it on your skin, watch it move leaves and smoke, sense its presence in your own breathing. That concreteness may explain why ancient testimonies sometimes depict him as making philosophy more accessible again after the stark abstraction of his predecessor. Yet his choice is not a mere retreat into the familiar. By insisting on the measurable processes of rarefaction and condensation, he makes it easier to imagine how one substance can give rise to many forms without invoking mysterious separations of opposites. Where Anaximander had spoken of hot and cold, wet and dry, disentangling themselves from the apeiron, Anaximenes can tell a more physical story. As air thins, it heats. As it thickens, it cools and liquefies. With further compression, it hardens. Quality rides on quantity. This move anticipates a habit of thought that will become central centuries later. The reduction of qualitative change to the reconfiguration of a more basic medium. When we say today that temperature is a matter of molecular motion or that color depends on wavelengths of light, we are descendants of this way of thinking. Of course, Anaximenes lacks the conceptual tools and experimental techniques that make modern physics possible. His air is not a gas made of molecules, but a continuous living field. Yet the intuition that differences in texture, temperature, and solidity might all be modes of a single underlying stuff is already there. His use of air as a bridging concept between body and world also echoes in later philosophical and religious traditions. In many languages, the words for breath, spirit and soul are closely linked. Greek has pneuma, Latin has spiritus, Hebrew has ruach. Anaximenes stands at an early point in that convergence. The same invisible reality that fills the lungs, animates the body, and leaves at death also extends across the sky as wind. The intuition is simple and profound. Whatever it is that makes us alive is not entirely confined inside us. It is part of the wider world. To breathe is to participate in something larger. We can try to imagine him walking through Miletus on an autumn day when the weather is changing. A wind off the sea cools the city after a stretch of oppressive heat. Clouds roll in, their undersides dark, gathering moisture. Somewhere over the open water, the hot air that baked the city is rising. Cooler air flows in to take its place. The sailors in the harbor read these signs for the sake of navigation. Anaximenes reads them as evidence of the pattern. Air expands and rises when warmed. It contracts and descends when cooled. In these cycles, he sees the skeleton of his cosmology. Rarefied air as fire, condensed air as water and earth, the ceaseless transformations of the same invisible medium. Fragmentary reports suggest that he also speculated about meteorological phenomena, lightning, thunder, hail, rainbows, again seeking to derive them from the play of air and its condensations. Lightning might be fire suddenly released when clouds are rent. Thunder, the sound of that rupture in dense, moist air. Hail, the product of raindrops frozen as they fall through cold layers. The details are less important than the method. Instead of seeing storms as quarrels among gods, he parses them as physical events in a continuous medium. Each new explanation is an assertion that the world can be approached without recourse to divine personalities. That does not mean he is a modern secularist. The universe for him is still ensouled, still full of a kind of sacred breath. But the sacred now works through regular processes rather than arbitrary acts. One way to sense the distance he travels from mythic thinking is to consider how his explanations would sound to someone raised on Homer. In the Iliad and the Odyssey, winds have names and characters, Boreas, Notus, Zephyrus, and they act at the behest of gods. When they wreck a ship or spare one, it is because some deity has a grievance or a favor to bestow. To say, as Anaximenes effectively does, that wind is just air in motion, thickening and thinning according to temperature and terrain, is to undercut that dramatic narrative. It is to say that the events that once carried the weight of divine intention might be accounted for without such agents. In place of a world full of stories, he offers a world full of processes. It would be easy to caricature this as a loss, a disenchantment. Yet for thinkers like Anaximenes, it is also a liberation. If the behavior of air can be understood in terms of regular patterns, then human beings can learn to predict and perhaps harness it. Sailors who know the local winds well can choose better times to depart and safer routes. Farmers who grasp how clouds form and disperse can read the sky more reliably. Even at this early stage, the impulse to understand nature carries with it the faint promise of control, or at least of reduced helplessness. Knowledge of air is practical as well as speculative. Within the small circle of Milesian philosophy, Anaximenes' doctrine also serves another role. It shows a way forward after Anaximander's daring but elusive apeiron. If the first principle is totally indefinite, there is a risk that it becomes too remote to guide concrete explanations. Air, by contrast, is both metaphysical and empirical. It has a kind of eternity. It is always there, underlying change. But it also shows up in daily life. You can test its behavior, however crudely, by watching how breath feels, how fog appears and dissipates, how wind cools or dries. In this sense, Anaximenes offers a more testable vision of unity. He brings the arche slightly closer to the range of things one can observe and manipulate. At the same time, his theory preserves something of Anaximander's commitment to a single, all-encompassing source. Air for Anaximenes is not just one element among others. It is the substratum from which the others are derived. When air condenses and thickens, it does not simply mix with water or earth, it becomes them. When it rarefies, it does not merely accompany fire, it is transformed into fire. The world is not a collage of fundamentally different materials, but a self-transforming continuum. This insistence on unity sits at the root of later philosophical monisms. in which everything, from matter to mind, is traced back to one principle. We can see his influence, faint but persistent, in the way later Greek thinkers talk about the soul and the cosmos. Stoic philosophers, centuries after him, will describe the universe as pervaded by a divine pneuma, a fiery breath that gives form and cohesion to all things. They will imagine the human soul as a fragment of this cosmic breath, and they will speak of fate not as the decree of a distant god, but as the rational unfolding of an immanent logos in the pneuma itself. Anaximenes is not a Stoic, and his air is simpler, less articulated. But the kinship is clear. Both pictures use breath-like stuff as the medium that ties together physics, psychology, and theology. From a modern vantage point, we can also appreciate the sheer imaginative effort involved in his attempt to picture the universe as made of something so intangible. It is one thing to say all is water, another to say all is an undefined indefinite, and yet another to say all is air in various states of density. Each move demands a different sort of intellectual courage. Water is visible and palpable. It is easy to imagine it thickening into mud or vanishing as steam. The apeiron is not visible at all, known only as the necessary background for opposites. Air lies in between. We do not see it directly, but we infer its presence from effects. It is invisible, but not wholly mysterious. Anaximenes chooses as first principle something that is both elusive and constantly experienced, both ordinary and subtle. That choice models a certain stance toward reality, a willingness to trust inference from everyday phenomena. You cannot see air itself, but you can see dust and leaves move, feel pressure on your skin, watch clouds and mist form and dissolve. From these clues, you can build a picture of something continuous, weight-bearing, omnipresent. In a similar way, you cannot see the underlying unity of all things, but you can see enough transformations to suspect that one exists, and you can propose air as its name. The move is modest in means and grand in ambition. Anaximenes, like the other early Milesians, stands at a moment when philosophy has not yet split into the many disciplines we know today. Questions about what everything is made of, how life arises, why the heavens move as they do, and what holds the self together are still entangled. When he talks about air, he is talking at once about matter, life, weather, and divinity. The modern listener, trained to put these topics into separate boxes, can learn something from that older entanglement. It suggests that the urge to separate our inquiries too sharply may hide their common roots. Imagine listening to a bonus episode in your series where Anaximenes is introduced not as a remote, dusty name in the history of philosophy, but as a man walking through his city, thinking with his skin and lungs as much as with his abstract reason. You could invite the listener to feel their own breath, to perform the warm and cool experiment with exhalation, to notice the subtle pressure of the atmosphere on their bodies. From there, you could let Anaximenes' thought unfold, the spectrum from fire to stone, the floating earth, the fiery heavenly wheels, the soul as air holding us together, the world as a living, breathing whole. In that way, the distance of 26 centuries shrinks, and the early Greek quest for an arche becomes part of a much longer human effort to understand the invisible medium we inhabit. If his predecessors asked, in effect, what is the world made of? Anaximenes adds a nuance. How can small, continuous changes in one thing yield the bewildering variety we see? His answer, air thickening and thinning, may not satisfy a modern physicist, but the underlying pattern of explanation still shapes how we think. Wherever someone proposes that very different phenomena are really variations in a single field or fabric, the old Milesian's instinct is alive. He died long ago, his writings mostly lost, his name preserved in a handful of later reports. Yet each time a storm front rolls in and we watch the sky darken, each time we step from a stuffy room into a cool night and feel the relief of fresh air, we reenact, in miniature, the experiences that fed his questions. To live on the surface of a planet wrapped in atmosphere is to be constantly in contact with the kind of thing he elevated to cosmic status. In that sense, Anaximenes is not the spokesman for some exotic doctrine, but the first philosopher of the obvious, the one who dared to say that the most taken-for-granted element of our lives is also the most fundamental. To think with him, even briefly, is to be reminded that philosophy does not always begin with remote problems or tortured puzzles. Sometimes it begins with a breath held before speaking, a breeze against the palm of a hand, a cloud's changing border. Out of those small sensations, a picture grows of a world that is not a patchwork of separate substances, but a single, restless medium, forever thickening and thinning, warming and cooling, stirring and settling. Anaximenes named that medium air. We might, following his lead, notice how much of our own thinking, even in an age of molecules and fields, still depends on metaphors of breath and atmosphere. There is another way to see his place in the unfolding story of early Greek thought. Thales, Anaximander, and Anaximenes can be read as a kind of three-move experiment with the idea of a first principle. Start with something concrete and wet, like water. Realize that no concrete element can easily generate its opposite, and so leap to a wholly indefinite aperon. Then feel the pullback toward the tangible, and pick an element that is both subtle and everywhere, such as air. Equip it with a mechanism, condensation and rarefaction, that can imitate the aperon's generative power while remaining tied to experience. In that sense, Anaximenes is not a mere ethagone polishing his teacher's ideas. He is the one who tries to reconcile their insights, to keep the link between explanation and observation from snapping. His choice of air also gives his philosophy a distinct emotional color. Water, as Thales presents it, suggests depth, fertility, and the power to nourish or destroy. The aperon suggests something inexhaustible and beyond all images. Air suggests something more intimate and fragile. You do not live in water, you would drown. You live in air, and it lives in you. It can be still or violent, harsh or soft, suffocating or refreshing. It is the element of voice and sound, the carrier of words. When Anaximenes equates soul with air, he is also, implicitly, equating thought with breath, logos with pneuma. The very act of speaking his theory embodies it. He shapes air as he says that all things are air. Consider how this would play in a culture where oral performance is still the main vehicle of serious discourse. The thinker stands before listeners in the agora or a private gathering and speaks about the nature of the world. His words ride on breath. His arguments depend on controlled exhalation. The audience hears about air as the archē while being literally enveloped by it and filled with it. The theory is not a remote speculation about a substance in the far reaches of the cosmos. It is about the medium of communication and life in which the conversation takes place. A good bonus episode on Anaximenes can make that visceral for the modern. Listener inviting them to notice the texture of their own breathing as they absorb the story. Of course, his vision did not go uncontested, even in antiquity. Other pre-Socratic thinkers would soon challenge the Milesian project of explaining everything in terms of one stuff. Heraclitus would emphasize flux and conflict, seeing fire and the logos rather than air as the key. Parmenides would attack the whole notion that being can emerge from non-being, or that what truly is can change, throwing into doubt any attempt to describe the world's origin in terms of a material principle. Empedocles would multiply the basic elements into four, rejecting the idea that any single one could underlie all things. In that crowded field, Anaximenes can seem, at first glance, like a transitional figure, overshadowed by more dramatic personalities. Yet if you listen closely, the problem he is wrestling with, how to link the unity of nature with the variety of appearances in a way that stays anchored in observation, remains central all the way through. Even modern debates about reductionism and emergence echo his concerns. When neuroscientists claim that consciousness arises from patterns of neural firing, or when physicists say that solid objects are mostly empty space structured by fields, They are, in a way, repeating his claim that familiar qualities ride on the behavior of something more fundamental. Critics of reductionism, meanwhile, worry that such accounts flatten the richness of experience, much as one might object that calling everything air in motion fails to do justice to the difference between a human face and a storm cloud. Anaximenes' theory thus gives you a very old template for a very current argument. Does explaining qualitative differences in terms of a continuous substratum illuminate the world, or does it strip away what matters? For someone organizing a series on the history of philosophy, there is also a narrative reason to linger with him. If you move too quickly from Thales and Anaximander to Heraclitus and Parmenides, you risk treating the early period as a mere prologue. Anaximenes allows you to show that even within that first generation of Milesians, there was already a back and forth, a self-correction. The story is not a straight line from myth to reason, but a set of overlapping attempts to hold on to what seemed right in earlier ideas while fixing what seemed inadequate. Thales sensed that there is one underlying thing, Anaximander's sense that the origin must transcend any determinate quality, and Anaximenes' insistence on a visible connection to experience all deserve to be heard together. Finally, there is something almost poetic in the way his chosen element mirrors the fate of his own name. Air leaves few traces. It flows, it carries, it allows life, but it is not easily preserved. Anaximenes' treatise, like his breath, has long since dissipated. What we have are echoes, paraphrases, compressed reports in later authors who had their own agendas. To reconstruct his thought is to listen for a voice carried to us across centuries of interpretive wind. That fragility can itself become part of the episode's mood. You can invite your listeners to imagine how many early insights may have swirled through the ancient world and vanished, leaving only faint impressions in those who came after. Anaximenes is one of the few whose outline we can still make out in that weathered landscape. Seen this way, he is not just a name on a timeline, but a reminder of how philosophy begins, not with a fixed canon, but with living people taking risks on new ways of explaining what everyone else takes for granted. He takes the most ordinary of elements, air, and asks his contemporaries to see it as the root of all things. Whether they agreed or not, the act itself widened the space of possible thinking. In that widening lies his true importance, and it is what makes him worth a full, breathing, 4,000-word exploration rather than a footnote.
Midnight rails on her silver moon, dusty boots on a winding road. A shadow's the only friend I've known since she packed up and let me go. Empty whiskey bottle on the sea, her laugh still echoes in my bones. Saddle's heavy with memories. I ride alone where the wind still blows. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. don't want a lonesome soul. Every town I pass feels half her size. Every trail's haunted by goodbye. I whisper prayers to open skies, hoping someday my heart'll find a brand new path beyond the pain, where broken hearts can heal in time. Nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be, nowhere else to be. Thank you.